I want you to imagine for a moment that I'm in possession of a time machine. It's a large time machine. It can take all of you back 1 year to the end of 2015. And I hand you all, we go back for a year, and I hand you all a slip of paper. And on the slip of paper, there are three spaces. And I ask each one of you to predict for 2016 the outcome of three different events. Okay, so who will win the Premiership in 2016, the Football Premiership? What will be the outcome of the EU referendum? And who will win the American presidential race? Okay, they're your three options. You've got a slip of paper in front of you. You're facing the year 2016. What are you saying? I'm guessing they were, some of you maybe would get one. Maybe a lot of you would get one of those. Maybe a handful would get two. I reckon none of you would have got all three. 1 year ago, would have predicted that Leicester would win the Premiership, that the EU referendum vote would be out, Brexit, and that Donald Trump would be president-elect of the United States. It's been a year of shocks, hasn't it? And the passage that Heidi's just read to us is, well, it's a prediction. Or it's more than that. The Bible called it a prophecy. A foretelling of what will come to be. A bold statement. Maybe an even bolder statement than Britain will vote Brexit, Donald Trump will be the president, and Leicester will win the Premiership. The prophet Isaiah, a man living around somewhere around the 700 BC mark, 700 years before Jesus, speaks these words. To us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. 700 years before Jesus comes to live in Israel, in modern day Palestine, born in Bethlehem, brought up in Nazareth, living his life, his working life around Galilee and Jerusalem and Judea. And we're going to look at that prophecy this morning because I think it's helpful to us as we ask, what's Christmas really about? What does the Bible, what does the God of the Bible promise to us? What does it mean that a child will be born? So we're going to look firstly at the context of the prophecy. What's going on at this time? A man called Ahaz is king of Judah. The nation of Israel is split. There's a northern kingdom, Israel, and there's a southern kingdom, Judah. And the country of Judah, God's people, are threatened. There's a threat on its northern border. Israel is a threat to Judah. And then the superpower of the day, Assyria, is a threat to Judah. In fact, if you turn back in your Bibles, one page, we find, so you see the large number 7 there, the sign of Emmanuel, bottom left hand side of the previous page, 692. When Ahaz, son of Jotham, the son of Uzziah, was king of Judah, King Rezin of Aram and Pekah of Remaliah, king of Israel, marched up to fight against Jerusalem, but they could not overpower it. To start with, two countries, two nations coming against Judah, coming against God's people. And whilst initially they couldn't overpower it, the outcome is the potential for Judah is bleak. The outlook is bleak. The country is a shadow of its former self. It's literally been cut in two. They've abandoned the beliefs and the morals of former times and previous generations. The current king is wicked in the sight of God. God says that of him. He doesn't live as he should. He doesn't lead the people as he should. It is a dark and hopeless time for this people. The country is going south. And God is going to let it happen. For they've rejected him. But in the midst of that, in the midst of the darkness, there is hope. To look at the content of the prophecy. Turn back to chapter 9. Flick over the page again. Look at verse 2. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light. On those living in the land of deep darkness, a light has dawned. There's a scene in the second Lord of the Rings film. A great battle is going on. And the hero Gandalf the Wizard has ridden off at the start of the battle, before it's even begun. And he said to his friends, "Look for me on the dawning of the fifth day." The battle has gone ill. This massive army is marching on the city. And they are slowly but surely overpowering the defenders. As night turns into day, as day turns into night, more of the defenders are killed. And even though they kill many, there's still more and more of the armies coming. And then suddenly, on the dawn, at dawn on the fifth day, a light comes over the hill. And it's Gandalf with an army. They ride down the hill and they win. Spoiler. That's the picture that Isaiah is describing. To a country that is a shadow of its former self, to a people that are hopeless, who can only see bad things on the horizon, he says, there is hope. It is like the sun coming up in the midst of darkness. The people walking in darkness have seen a great light, a little shaft of light that turns into a great sunrise. There is hope. But what is the hope of? Well, look further down. Look at verse 3. You have enlarged the nation and increased their joy. They rejoice before you as people rejoice at the harvest, as warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder. It's almost Christmas joy. It's the joy of a child at Christmas, waking up at, you know, some unearthly hour, running downstairs and getting to open the presents. The joy of harvest. The joy of effort spent and the results coming in. For a people who only see darkness, he says, this is what's set before you. Joy, deep joy. As warriors rejoice when dividing the plunder, a victory has been won. There is relief and release and reward. The hope of joy. And there's the hope of freedom. Verse 4, for as in the day of Midian's defeat, you have shattered the yoke that burdens them, the bar across their shoulders, the rod of their oppressor. What's interesting about this is that Isaiah is going to speak this prophecy to the people. And yet, not too long afterwards, they are going to be a people in captivity. They'll be taken from their land, from their homes, into another nation. And they'll be away, taken, captive. And yet he says to them, what God is promising you, there is hope of freedom. Not just temporary freedom, not just the freedom that they kind of have now, which is we're free, but there are enemies coming who may overwhelm us. But true freedom. And there's the hope of peace. Verse 5. Every warrior's boot used in battle, every garment rolled in blood will be destined for burning, will be fuel to the fire. Every little bit of warfare toolage will be taken and will no longer have to be put aside for possibly be used in the future. Libby, my wife, is due in 3 weeks with our second child, and she's going through a nesting stage. And basically that means that my stuff is getting thrown out. That's the way I see it. But a lot of the stuff that I keep because, well, there might come a time when I use it again. Now, realistically, I'm at a point where I'm not spending every day playing sport. I probably don't need tennis trainers and squash trainers and golf clubs and football boots with slightly longer studs and all the stuff that I've amassed as a single man. for my sporting pleasure. I keep, because I think, well, there might come a time when I play that again. And I'm a bit of a hoarder. But this hope of peace says that the things that are used in warfare will be able to be thrown out and burnt. Because the surety of the peace that God is promising, it's not a, well, there'll be peace for a time. But at some point in the future, you might need to go back into your cupboard and get your tools out again. There's no need to keep the swords or the bow and arrow, even in the attic. How many of our attics are full of stuff that we think we might possibly use in the future? But as God promises through Isaiah, a peace that means that all of that can be thrown out. That's the peace that he's describing, the hope of joy, the hope of freedom, the hope of peace. That's quite a triple combo, isn't it? Joy, freedom, and peace. That's the content of the prophecy. This is what is promised by God to his people. And isn't that the world that we all want? Isn't that the life that we all want? A life of joy, a life of being free, a life of peace. You see, we might not be a nation like Israel was, Judah was. We might not be fearing, you know, imminent warfare, but we do live in a world where peace is sought after. We're aware that we're often not at peace with one another. We're often aware that on the inside, our hearts are not like a gentle sea with barely a ripple on it. It often feels our insides are like a storm, tossing and turning. We're aware that our relationships with other peoples are tempestuous. And even if we're really good at keeping it all down inside, and people don't know that we're struggling so much with what they say or what they've done, maybe some of us are already thinking, I'm going home for Christmas and it's going to be hard because of this incident, or because of that relationship, or because that person's coming for Christmas dinner. Don't we want freedom? How many of us are aware of not really being free? Not really being free to be able to live how we want to live, how we know that we ought to live. Maybe we're not outwardly addicted, or maybe we are to alcohol, or, you know, to cigarettes, but maybe we're addicted to how other people see us. We have to be seen to be a good person. We're addicted to the applause of the crowd. Even though there's no crowd, there are just friends and family and church members. The battery gone? Okay. How many of us are searching for joy? How many of us are just thinking Christmas, let's get through it? Because it's all amped up. We spend, you know, basically 6 months now of the year building up to Christmas, and it gets there and it's a letdown. How many of us are hoping for that, looking for that inward, deep happiness that can't be taken away in an instant, in a moment? As it is for the nation of Judah, so it is for individuals like us. This is the claim. This is the promise that God has got an interest in the joy, in the freedom, in the peace of people. God has an interest in your joy, in your freedom, in your peace. It's so easy to think that nobody wants good things for us. Nobody understands what I really need. Nobody really cares. And if there is a God, surely he doesn't give a stuff about me because I'm not happy. God has an interest in the joy and the freedom and the peace of people, in the joy and the freedom and the peace of you. But how is God going to do this? How is this all going to come about? This is the world or the life that we all want, but we know we can't do it. Because we've tried. We're constantly trying. Searching for freedom, searching for peace, searching for joy. And so the second half of the prophecy is about the one that we all need. For the world that we all want, there is a hero we all need, and it's not us. It's not us. Here's the description of the one that God will send. Okay, 8 points, just to really put the fear in you, but I'm going to go through very quickly. Okay. Firstly, a child. Secondly, a ruler. Thirdly, a wonderful counselor. Mighty God, everlasting Father, Prince of Peace, David's true son, and a man, a child who is guaranteed by God. We're going to run through the passage really quickly. Look down at verse 6. For to us a child is born, to us a son is given. There's so many amazing carols that we sing at Christmas, even if Matt Dexter doesn't like them. Okay? And some of them are duds, it has to be said. But there are some amazing words in carols. One of them says this: lo, within a manger lies he who built the starry skies. He who, throned in height sublime, sits among the cherubim. It's a great mystery that the one who is going to bring about this great hope is a child. For to us a child is born. One of the commentators says this: in his coming, all the results from his coming is at once secured. It's the Christmas scene, isn't it? You're going to see on the Christmas cards that you get the nativity scene, the little stable, the manger, baby, people sat around. How can it be that that child will bring everything that God has promised? How can it be that in that moment in time, it is absolutely secure that there will be this everlasting peace, this joy that cannot be taken away, this freedom that will never be removed? And it comes in a child, a baby. Actually, Isaiah has already talked about a baby that will come. Again, flip back to chapter 7 on the previous page. In the midst of all that's going on, the turmoil in this nation at the time, Isaiah speaks about what God will do. A sign that God will give, that he's at work, that he's concerned about his people. Chapter 7, verse 14: therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. The virgin will conceive and give birth to a son, and will call him Emmanuel. Emmanuel means God with us. It's a crazy statement. The virgin will conceive. Okay, we're not doing basic biology here, but I'm hoping that you understand what that means. It doesn't make sense. And yet this is an unmistakable sign from God. It's helpful like that. Because if it was the girl who isn't a virgin conceives, we kind of go, yeah, that happens quite a lot. But here is an unmistakable sign from God that he's at work, that he's at work for his people. A child. And the child will be a ruler, and the government will be on his shoulders. He will bear on his shoulders the burden of leadership. What's funny is that there's a little contrast there. Flip back up to verse 4. God's promise to his people is that the bar across their shoulders will be taken away. How will that be taken away? By the shoulders of this child bearing the weight of government. To a contrast, that how will we be freed? Because he will take the weight. He will do it for us because we cannot. He will be called Wonderful Counselor. He will be a man who speaks wisdom supernatural wisdom, beyond understanding, beyond comprehension. He will speak that into the lives of people. He will be called Mighty God. What is Christmas about? It is that God became man. How will God achieve peace, joy, freedom for his people? He will take on humanity. It is a title that even as the Jesus is born in Bethlehem, he already has this title of being Mighty God. You think, how can it be? He's not earned that yet. How can a child be a mighty God? We understand maybe a little bit how a man could have God-like character, but in the same way in our royal family, the moment that a child is born into the royal family, the moment that Prince George came along for the very first second, he's a prince. In the same way the baby in the manger is God. And he's the everlasting Father, fifth. And maybe this is the bit that we really struggle to get our heads around. How can Jesus, the baby, who is called the Son of God, how can he be an everlasting Father? Well, maybe a helpful way to think about this is that he's the Father of the everlasting, or the Father of eternity. Switch it round. Do you know how we call some people, or some people are called, the father of such and such? So Galileo is the father of modern science, or Florence Nightingale is the mother, apparently, of nursing. This idea that somebody is so defining a topic or a career, that every person who follows in their footsteps is influenced by them, even if they've never met them. Every scientist is influenced by what Galileo said, what he understood and taught. In the same way, Jesus is the author of all things eternal. The Father of the eternal. Father of eternity. Everything that will last through eternity, for eternity, is shaped by Jesus. He starts it all, he keeps it all, he commands it all. Through him and for him are all things, Paul says in Colossians. And he's the Prince of Peace. He brings peace. Peace between men and men. Oh, men and women. Jesus is enables peace between people like us. One of the great witnesses of the church, or should be, that people who are so different can love one another, can care for one another, can have compassion for each other, can live together. Because something has united them. Something enables the church, people like us, to lay aside our own desires, our own pleasures, our own wants for the good of other people. How is that possible? Because of Jesus. And because he is the Prince of Peace. And he does that because, more importantly, he creates, he makes peace between men and women and God. The great divide between us and the God who made us. That is there because by nature we reject him. We reject his goodness. We reject his rule. We reject that things are about him and for him. Each one of us, quite naturally, is at war with God. It comes on pure instinct to us. And yet, Jesus is able to bring peace between us and God. A God who quite would be in all of his rights to judge us, to send us to eternal punishment that the Bible calls hell, to have nothing to do with us. Because of Jesus, we are enabled to come to him as our Father. He makes peace through his blood on the cross. Christmas is about Easter. Jesus is born to bring peace, and he brings peace by going to the cross. He is the Prince of Peace, and he is, seventhly, David's true son. Down at verse 7. Of the greatness of his government and peace, there will be no end. He will reign on David's throne and over his kingdom, establishing it and upholding it with justice and righteousness from that time on and forever. And that moment, as Jesus is born, a line is drawn in the sand, because the reign of King Jesus has begun. And it's a reign that has been promised. David was the king of Israel before it was divided. He was God's chosen man, a man after God's own heart. And God had said to him, David, I'm going to work through you, through your offspring. I'm going to put your son, somebody from your line, on the throne. And no longer will it be a broken kingdom. No longer will it be like the last presidency or the next king. Kind of goods, some faults, only last for a time. No, David, I'm going to put your son on the throne and he will reign forever. And it will be a perfect reign. It will be a reign where every decision is right. Every citizen of that kingdom will be joyful. There will be no inequity. There will be no rich and poor. There will be no some profiting at the expense of others. It will be better than the very best kingdoms of this world. And it will last forever. And eighthly, this is guaranteed by God. Just look down at that final sentence. The zeal of the Lord Almighty will accomplish this. God's unwavering, faithful, completely assured seal that he will do this. That he will bring about this hope. He will bring about this peace. He will bring about this joy. He will bring about complete freedom. God will do it. The word zeal has got this idea of committed effort that is driven by love. God will do it. This strength that comes from deep love and affection, a committed, active love. God will do it. And so let's ask the question then, how do we respond to this great promise? A baby in a manger is God himself. He's going to bring peace and joy and freedom for those living in darkness. The light has dawned. Maybe you've even seen the glimpse of it this morning. There is hope for each one of us, because this prophecy came true. Remember I said this was prophecy was made 700 years before Jesus was born. And yet 700 years down the line, we see these words coming to life in a little baby born to Mary, conceived though she was a virgin, coming from the land of Galilee. You see that at the start? Verse 1. Nevertheless, there will be no more gloom for those who are in distress. In the past, he humbled the land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali. But in the future, he will honour Galilee of the nations. And here we see the boy, the child who is given, grows up and goes into Galilee. It's there that he acts and speaks and works. It's there that he saves and raises people to life and heals the sick. It's there that he casts out demons. And suddenly, Galilee, this insignificant place, is the talk of the town. is enshrined forever in the Word of God as the place where Jesus was at work, where the Son of God showed himself and changed people forever. The prophecy came true. They called the baby in a manger, they called him Emmanuel. God with us. None of us might have predicted the year of 2016 successfully on a national level. Maybe not even on a personal level. Maybe we didn't know what was coming this year. Maybe we didn't know that hardships were coming. Maybe you didn't know that successes were coming either. But God promises that this will happen, and it has happened. And prophecy is in past tense. Did you notice that? The people in walking in darkness have seen a great light. There is a certainty about what Isaiah says, about what God says, about what will take place. The light has dawned, and we see wise men following a great light to come to find Jesus and to worship him. So, 2 points as I close. Firstly, well, maybe you've never seen Jesus before. Maybe you've never seen who he is and what it means that he has come. Maybe the things that you are looking for, actually we find that God has promised through Jesus. Do you see what it was that brought the joy to the people in verse 3? You have enlarged the nation. Soon after these words that Isaiah speaks, like I said before, this people will be taken into captivity. The nation will be dissolved. And some will come back, but it's a smaller number, less significant. And soon there'll just be a small number of people who are trusting God. But that insignificant remnant, God says, I'm going to grow a large people. I'm going to enlarge the nation. He's going to take a small number and make it into a great multitude. The Bible says that on the final day, there will be a great multitude, more people than you could possibly count, who will stand and worship God for what he has done, for who he is and what he's done for them. And maybe even this morning, the call is to you. God has promised that he will do this, and he has done it. And he's saying, will you accept the gift? For to us a son is given. Jesus has been given so that we might come to know God, that we might be in that enlarged nation. Jesus is going to take away every obstacle that stands between you and God. All of your sin, all of your wrongdoing, all of your rejection of God, all the mistakes you've made, all the things that are offensive about you to God, he takes them upon himself on the cross. So will you come and accept the gift? Even this morning, will you come and worship him? Find in him joy, freedom, peace. And secondly, we need to stop looking for those things elsewhere. Only through Jesus has God promised to give us this. Put everything else in its right place. That's what it is, isn't it? Because Christmas becomes about so many other things, so many good things. But what if this Christmas everything else is stripped away? The family, the Christmas films, the food, the presents, the time off from work. What if everything else is taken away? For Christians, that does not remove our joy. It doesn't take away our peace. It does not make us any less free. And yet we're so prone to looking for those things and even finding shadows of those things elsewhere. I know I am. If all those things were stripped away, would you still know the peace of heart? Would you still know the freedom from self-doubt, self-loathing, self-harm? Would you still have the joy that warms your inmost being better than any Christmas alcoholic drink? But alas, has Christmas become about everything but Jesus? As we look ahead to this Christmas, this next week, let me encourage you to return to Jesus, the gift that has been given. I'm not saying you've got to get rid of everything else. I want to encourage us to have it in the right perspective. Worship and treasure Jesus, for he is the gift that has been given to us. We're going to sing shortly a carol that invites us to come and worship Jesus, and the band are going to come up now. But maybe just for a minute, why don't you turn to God, respond to him, maybe for the first time, and say, God, if this is true, show me more. And maybe you're at a point where you can say, I do believe this. God, help me to accept the gift that you have given in Christ. After about a minute, we'll stand and sing, Come On You Faithful.